headlines. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei describes the poisoning of school children in the country as an unforgivable crime, calling on authorities to investigate the issue. Authorities in Bangladesh launched an investigation into a massive fire in a Rohingya refugee camp that left around 12,000 of the Muslims without shelter. And dozens of Israeli Air Force reservists canceled a training day, protested the so-called judicial reforms proposed by the regime's far-right cabinet. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on officials to seriously pursue the issue of poisoning of students after cases were reported in a number of cities. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the poisonings are a major and unforgivable crime. The leader says the perpetrators must be handed the maximum punishment if the incidents are proven to be poisonings. Cases of such attacks have been reported in dozens of schools for girls over the past months. The incidents have reportedly left an unspecified number of the students hospitalized. President Ibrahim Raisi has already ordered the Ministers of Intelligence and the Interior to follow up on the case. Iran has said that it has complied with the safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as the Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT. That's according to the country's head of the Atomic Energy Organization. Mohammad Islami made the remark one day after the Director General of the IAEA paid a two-day visit to Tehran. Islami noted that the UN nuclear watchdog's inspections of Iran's nuclear activities must be conducted in accordance with a law enacted by Iran's parliament. The legislation, titled Strategic Action Plan, was passed in 2020 to counter sanctions and to develop the country's nuclear program. Islami also talked about obligations under the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA, which was torpedoed after Washington withdrew from it. He underlined that the accord cannot be used as a basis for Iran's cooperation with the IAEA, since the Western parties to the pact don't adhere to it. Meanwhile, Islami rejected allegations that Iran has exceeded its declared 60% uranium enrichment. He said the issue has now been settled with IAEA.
The stalemate between Tehran and the three remaining signatories to the Iran deal over reviving the 2015 landmark agreement has once again brought the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, to the Iranian capital. Rafael Grossi held talks with a number of Iranian officials, including President Ebrahim Raisi, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. During a joint press conference with Iran nuclear chief, Grossi said his meetings in Iran took place in an atmosphere of cooperation.
The atmosphere is an atmosphere of work, of honesty and cooperation, and I think this is it is the most important thing. Our dialogue will continue today.
The IAEA chief also expressed hope that his meetings with Iranian officials would produce good results.
We are working hard. What I can tell you is that our teams, we have been working. Now we are taking recess to come and talk to you. But we are working hard in order to have good solutions today.
He also hailed his meetings with Iranian authorities as constructive.
By having a constructive discussion like we are having now and having good agreements like I am sure we are going to have, we are going to be paving the way for important agreements, and this is my hope.
Iran atomic chief also addressed reporters. Islami said the Islamic Republic has no reservation about advancing its nuclear program, adding that the country will not give up on its national interests. Regarding claims about uranium enrichment, Islami said the IAEA's report has confirmed Iran has not enriched uranium beyond its declared 60%. He added the issue has now been resolved between the two sides. Islami underlined that the meetings show Tehran and the IAEA maintain professional relationship.
The visit by the head of the IAEA comes as the UN agency is accused of bias when it comes to Iran's nuclear program. Tehran is critical of the agency's political approach and says the UN watchdog is under the influence of Israel, which is not even a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
The recent visit by the IAEA chief to Iran comes as many throughout the world have raised doubts over the impartiality of the UN agency. This comes to the spotlight, especially when the UN nuclear watchdog has always failed to address questions about the agency's inspection of Israeli nuclear sites. During his press conference, Grossi argued that Israel is not a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, and therefore the agency cannot technically inspect Israeli sites. Given that, one would argue that the IAEA, along with the international community, have failed to pressure the Israeli regime to become a member of the agreement. After all, the regime in Tel Aviv possesses more than 400 nuclear warheads, which can by default be an enormous threat to the entire world. In the meantime, Iran has been critical of the UN agency for acting politically in cases related to the technical issues of the country's nuclear program. Tehran says the agency acts under the influence of certain countries, but the IAEA claims otherwise.
The IAEA has not been and will never be a political tool of anybody. I, as Director General, I am independent. I am under no country's instructions.
Iran's concern can be clearly felt in President Ebrahim Raisi's remarks when he met with Rafael Grossi on Saturday. President Raisi said Tehran will continue to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency if the IAEA preserves its independence and defend the rights of the Iranian people. Raisi said Tehran expects the agency's activities not to be under the influence of certain world powers who pursue their personal interests. The president called on the IAEA to express realities about Iran's nuclear program without any partiality and based on professional behavior. This is significantly debatable when one argues that the International Atomic Energy Agency has even failed to condemn terrorist attacks on Iranian nuclear sites as well as those targeting Iranian scientists. This is why the pressure is always coming from entities like Israel that are not even a party to the NPT. The pressure is also coming from countries like the United States that they themselves are in possession of hundreds or maybe thousands of nuclear warheads and a threat to humanity by nature.
Iran and Afghanistan have opened a joint permanent commercial center in Kabul. The venture brings together traders and investors from both countries to boost trade. Our correspondent Abdullah Amirzadeh reports.
Iran-Afghanistan Permanent Trade Center has been opened in the capital, Kabul. The center is in line with the two countries' policies of expanding bilateral ties and connecting business people of the two neighboring states. During the opening ceremony, Afghanistan's Minister of Industry and Commerce highlighted the country's expectations about trade between the two countries.
We expect to balance the trade with Iran. We want to export our goods to Iran, which enjoys a good market. Iran's export to Afghanistan is more than $2 billion a year, but I won't mention our export to Iran because it's a very small amount. We hope that Tehran modifies its laws so that we can increase our exports.
With the opening of this center in Kabul and its capabilities, it is believed that the Taliban government in Afghanistan is providing a platform for more economic connections between Tehran and Kabul.
This center is an example of good relations between Afghanistan and Iran. Both countries have a lot of potentials, and with the opening of this center, we hope that bilateral trade gets a big boost and Tehran and Kabul can be great partners.
The center has great capabilities which can have great effects on rebuilding Afghanistan and the war-torn country's infrastructure.
The priorities for this center are trade of industries, equipment and machineries, also food industry, mining industry and technology. We are also ready to set up an iron production line in Afghanistan. On the other side, mines and precious stones here are useful for Iran.
Iranian and Afghan officials hope that the center helps advance the export goals of the two countries. They highlighted that the development of sustainable trade and exports is the most important task of this center in Kabul.
Many believe the opening of such trade centers would have positive effects on Afghanistan's economy that has taken a lot of damage due to years of political and financial instability. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
A massive fire rips through a Rohingya refugee camp in Bangladesh, robbing around 12,000 people of their shelter. Flames swept through the Kutupalong camp and gutted some 2,000 huts before it was brought under control. 90 facilities, including hospitals and schools, were burnt down. Bangladeshi authorities are yet to release the number of casualties. They say an investigation is underway to determine the cause of the fire. An estimated 1 million Rohingya Muslims live in the world's largest refugee camp in Bangladesh. They escaped to Bangladesh in 2017 after genocide by the military in their homeland, Myanmar. At least 9 police officers are killed and 16 others wounded in a bombing attack in the southwest Pakistan. The bombing targeted a truck carrying part military forces in Quetta, Balochistan province. The suspected bomber rammed his explosive-laden motorbike into the vehicle. The death toll is expected to rise as the injured officers are reported to be in critical conditions. Shortly after the explosion, the Taliban in Pakistan claimed responsibility for the attack. The group has been blamed for a string of bombings and other terrorist attacks in Pakistan recently. Officials say such attacks have surged since August 2021, when the Taliban took power in Afghanistan. Nasser Kazmi is our correspondent joining us from Islamabad to tell us more about this. Well, Nasser, tell us exactly what has happened here.
As we have seen in the past, that the militancy in Pakistan is growing day to day, and today, again, this attack happened in southwestern Balochistan province, where 9 paramilitary troops have been killed in this attack. So far, the initial information which are coming from Quetta at the moment. Emergency have been declared in the province while the hospitals are on red alert. This was the second attack in less than 2 weeks, as the similar explosion occurred in the neighboring city of Mostong last week, and more than 5 people, 5 civilians were killed in the attack. This was the massive attack on the Pakistani security forces after the 2 attacks which took place, one in the southwestern Karachi province and then in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces, respectively. The government is trying its best to cope the situation at the moment, and we have seen that the Pakistani delegation, led by its ministers, went to Kabul and raised this issue of terrorism with the Afghan leadership. And Pakistan asked the Afghan authorities to handle those militants which are said to be hiding inside Afghanistan, especially these Tehrik-e-Taliban militants, which are close aid to Afghan Taliban at the moment. So the situation at the moment is that Pakistan is trying its best to deal the issue with through the negotiation with neighboring Afghanistan. However, we have seen that the insurgents are active in Pakistan, and they are carrying out attacks inside Pakistan in various cities. In Karachi, we have seen that the police headquarters were targeted, and similarly in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, we have seen that more than 100 police officials were killed in a massive explosion that occurred in a mosque. So Pakistan is trying its best, while we have seen that the security has been enhanced in all porous borders with Afghanistan, especially in Balochistan and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces, respectively. And we have seen that the trade activities were also stopped due to this the security. And this issue was also raised during the meeting between the Pakistani officials and the Afghan authorities in Kabul last week.
Thank you very much for that. Nasser Kazmi there from Islamabad. We appreciate it. Moving on, anger continues to flare up in Israel over judicial reforms proposed by the new far-right cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, dozens of Air Force reservists say that they will not turn up for a training day in protest. In a letter circulated in local media, 37 pilots and navigators from an F-15 squadron said they would skip drills scheduled for Wednesday. This comes amid weeks-long demonstrations against Netanyahu's policies. Some protest leaders, among them former military chiefs, say that Tel Aviv's policies could lead to mass disobedience within the ranks. The regime seeks changes that include curbs on the Supreme Court, which it accuses of overreach. Critics say Netanyahu wants excessive power over the judiciary. He's already on trial on graft charges. Johnny Miller has been covering the war in Ukraine from Donetsk for months. He's in Tehran now, and we talked to him face-to-face about his experience of the war. Miller says that Ukraine is shelling its own people, and that's why many people in the east of the country don't want to be part of it anymore.
That's essentially what Ukraine has been doing. People see it as its own civilians. And people say, well, it's just war. Well, it's not just war. Just shelling your own people you see as your own civilians is not just war. It's an important point to make. You know, when I go to the frontline villages on the outside of Donetsk, I don't call Ukraine out for that. There's civilians there. They're too close to the fighting. There's, in some areas near the front lines, obviously there's pro-Russian or Russian artillery pieces, not next to buildings, but when you're fighting on the outskirts of the city, you know, I don't call Ukraine out for that. But the center of Donetsk, where there's no military targets, that is just simply shelling. And as I said, there's various reasons for it. Sometimes I think I've been told they're just drunk sometimes with alcohol involved and they just fire them off. Secondly, for revenge, when you're not having success on the battlefield, just fire some Grad rockets at civilians. Mm-hmm. And also to try and terrorize the people to stop them supporting Ukraine. So there's various reasons for that. And it's been going on intermittently over the last 8, going on 9 years now. And since Russia sent its troops into Ukraine, it's escalated. Often Ukraine does target military targets. The HIMAR missiles, in my experience, the American HIMAR missiles, which are largely helped by the Americans in terms of targeting, they usually, in my experience, do target military targets. But the Grad missiles, other weapons, sometimes it's just shelling the center of Donetsk. And it's such an important story because it's the reason why the vast majority of people in the Donbass region that's controlled by Russia no longer want to be part of Ukraine.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
Dear passengers, welcome to Kashan.
This announcement means we have gone through half the way in our attractive journey to Yazd province. I am really eager to see Dolatabad Garden. You know, Persian gardens are very unique in the world. However, Dolatabad Garden is a jewel of Persian architecture. Must be a very different garden. Dolatabad Garden in Yazd, central Iran, is among the most iconic landscapes of Iran with distinctive properties, picture postcard views of water stream, and the historic Persian pavilions. The garden, which spans an area of 72,000 square meters, attracts a wide range of visitors to offer a memorable glimpse on the coexistence of ancient history and beautiful nature. This is one of the 9 Iranian gardens listed by UNESCO under the common title of Persian Gardens. The garden was built about 300 years ago as a residence for Muhammad Taghi Khan, also known as the Great Khan, who governed Yazd in the 18th century. The complex has been built according to the original Iranian architectural style and consists of a large garden and a number of buildings. Like other Persian gardens, water plays an important role in the ornamentation of the Dolatabad Garden. There are several kanats, waterways, and ponds within the garden. The lush garden is a paradise where different trees like pine and cypress, various flowers like roses and fruit trees like grape and pomegranate abound, offering a green carpet panorama. This complex includes a southern frontispiece building, a vestibule building, and a wind catcher, a summer building, Behesht or Paradise Building, a Mirror Hall Building, the Tehrani Building, the main frontispiece building, and a double-spanned water cistern. The soaring 34-meter-high wind catcher, the highest one in Iran, makes the state really unique, creating a spectacular vista. Dolatabad's famous wind catcher has octagonal panels that guide the wind inside the building.
Kindly attention, train to Yazd is arriving on time at platform number 4.
Taxi? My destination is Chahar Menar neighborhood, Dolatabad Garden, please. One of the old neighborhoods of Yazd is Chahar Menar neighborhood, located in the center of the city. Chaharminar is an area that includes the largest historical texture of Yazd in terms of area. This neighborhood is the only historical neighborhood of Yazd, the monuments of which have been inscribed by UNESCO in two periods. Dolatabad Garden, along with eight other Iranian gardens, was the first place inscribed in 2011. Sir, is there a long way to Dolatabad Garden?
Not a long way to go. We usually have no traffic here in Yazd.
Well, here it is. I've heard that once this street was home to a lot of trees. Tall trees which overshadowed this garden. Oh, God. The wind catcher is appearing. Wow, look at it. Such wind catchers are only seen in Iran. It's about 34 meters. It's octagonal, which lets the wind be directed into the building in every way. The wind which enters the building strikes the pool's water and then creates cool air inside the building. Imagine such a cool place in the heart of the desert. And I love these fountains. What a nice feeling is to be here. Wish you were here, honestly. And let me tell you something interesting. The main source of water in this garden is Dolatabad Kanat, or as we Iranians say, Kanat. Water streams are flowing in almost all parts of the garden. It's amazing. Let me enter the vestibule building. Here is actually the main pavilion of the garden and is mostly considered by its tall wind catcher. There is a marble pool in the middle of the pavilion. It's beautiful. And three spacious chambers. Oh, I love the arches of these windows and these colorful glasses. Oh, fascinating. I wish I lived in such a place for my whole life. This is just one of the pavilions of the garden. I wish I could describe all these beauties for you, but as they say, art is long, but time is short. Without any exaggeration, nowhere does have such amazing monuments like my beautiful Iran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. One of the news items making the headlines of Western mainstream media outlets is that China is increasing its military budget by 7.2%. What these corporate-owned stations fail to report is that even with this increase in its defense budget, China is still spending just over one-fourth of what the United States spends. China has the second-largest defense budget in the world after the U.S. Meanwhile, Washington is warning Beijing about supporting Russia in its war against Ukraine. China's foreign minister has responded by saying, "It's plain for the world to see who is calling for dialogue and striving for peace and who is adding fuel to the fire, handing out knives and instigating hostility." How dangerous is this scenario? We'll stay with us to find out all of this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. William Jones from Executive Intelligence Review out of Washington, D.C. And John Ross, Senior Fellow, Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off with William in Washington, D.C. Now, China has said that the reason it's increasing its defense budget is because of the escalating threats from abroad. Your assessment of this reason, is that true? And what does it all mean, really, in this this race for this military increase globally?
Well, I think it's absolutely the case. If you look at what the United States has been doing in its provocation, trying to create new alliances, partially of a military character in the Asia Pacific with Japan and Australia, continual and increased incursions into Taiwan Straits and the South China Sea, making a lot of trouble for China in that region, and also the general attempt to strangle China technologically by all the restrictions that are put on high technology products like semiconductors. This is a very hostile policy being imposed by the biggest military power in the world, which has a group of alliances in the so-called Western Alliance system that they has brought to bear in terms of putting pressure on China. So obviously, China, which is concerned for its own defense of its own borders, of its own region, has increased its defense budget. It's not as dramatic as the United States. The United States' increase in its defense budget, I believe, was 13% as compared to the 7% of the Chinese budget. But, of course, the United States is involved in a major war in Europe. China is just trying to defend itself. So that puts that in a much different context. But there is concern because the world situation is very turbulent and very uncertain. This has been made very clear by the Chinese president. And they're kind of, what I say, girding their loins. If any trouble would come, they would be prepared to meet that.
Well, John, if you agree with William, with his assessment just now, why do you think that the United States is getting more aggressive towards China?
Well, because it's losing in peaceful economic competition. The United States claims its economy is dynamic, etc., but the real reality is that it's losing in the competition to China. I mean, if we take the situation during in the pandemic, since the beginning of the pandemic, in the 3 years of the pandemic, China's economy grew 2.5 times as fast as the United States. China grew over 13%, the US just over 5%. If you take the addition to world GDP in this period, it's 36% to the to China and about 16% to the United States. Then if you look at the individual companies, the US can't compete in telecommunications with Huawei. TikTok has become the most popular, so therefore the US is trying to ban Huawei. TikTok has become the most visited website in the world, so the US is now considering banning TikTok. Hikvision is the best producer of cameras for surveillance, etc. I mean, for safety surveillance in the world. So the US can't compete with that. The US admits that the whole solar power industry is totally dominated by China. The US is losing in peaceful economic competition. The only place in which it maintains a lead is military, because it spends more than the next 9 countries in the world put together. So therefore, increasingly tends to try to put things on a military terrain. And this is very, very dangerous, because the world wants to get on with peaceful development, but the US wants to move things more and more towards military actions.
Well, William, you just heard what John said. So, I mean, if it's the case that the United States cannot compete, but what they can compete in is with their military, I mean, why wouldn't Washington change its focus? I mean, it was once actually a technologically advanced country. It was the main producer of goods at one point in a time in the world. So wouldn't it make sense for the United States to actually reinvest in the country to actually get it to be more competitive technologically instead of war? I mean, how do you see it?
Well, this would be the rational response to that. The United States, of course, through its own fault, through decisions that have been made over the past decades, has transformed itself from a major industrial power to what I would call a rentier power. They have the power of the dollar. So instead of producing steel or other products in Pennsylvania, they shut that down and moved to cheap labor countries that can produce it more cheaply. And this has led to the deindustrialization of the United States. And if you look at our infrastructure, not to speak of the most dramatic example of our infrastructure was the explosion, the train derailment in Ohio, is an indication of where the United States stands. So everybody is aware of the fact that the U.S. economy has really moved not only in comparison to China, but in comparison to what it once was, from a major power to a second-rate power. And there is an understanding that there should be this infrastructure development, but it's happening in the context of this competition with China, which is making it impossible for them politically to get people together to move toward a program of a revitalization of the U.S. economy, which would create a little more confidence and a little less warlike bearing on the part of our politicians, who, as John Ross indicated, are really frightened that they've become a secondary power. But the United States policymakers are not thinking rationally in this respect. They had an opportunity also, even with China's Belt and Road initiative, that was also offered to the United States. They were prepared to help build high-speed rail in the U.S., and that was rejected because it was China doing it and not the United States doing. So it's their own folly which has led them to a policy which is restrictive, is punitive, and could lead to war rather than a policy of trying to rebuild the economic potential of the United States. And that's put the world in a real dilemma at this point.
John, we know the U.S. is deeply involved with the Ukraine-Russia war. Could Washington possibly want to open another front as far as dealing with a military conflict. We understand that its military spending is number one in the world. But one would think that it would be extremely stretched and foolish to want to take on China head on. What do you think?
Well, yes, if you look at the situation statically, it would be very foolish. Right? You know, it's already got one very serious war going on, you know, with Ukraine, and one very powerful enemy, which is Russia. It seems stupid to create a second one. But the problem for the United States is time. It's not capable of rebuilding itself quickly. And as the more that time goes on, the stronger China's economy will become, and the more China will lead. And Russia is a much tougher opponent than the United States envisaged. I think that the United States thought when it went in for expanding NATO into Eastern Europe, which is what is really behind the war in Ukraine, that Russia would just accept this, roll over and say, oh, well, you know, you can advance your military alliance up to our borders and we're not going
to
do anything.
Well, John, sorry to interrupt you here. You just said something really interesting, that the United States thought that Russia would accept them expanding east. I mean, they have so many different think tanks and institutes and universities that actually study very strategic issues. Why would they think that that major threat, even to the existence of Russia, that Moscow would not have to actually defend itself to the end?
Well, because they have a rather arrogant and ignorant this combination of the two. They don't think they need to know the world. Everybody knows that if you look at the situation of Russia, Russia's history is that it's been constantly attacked by forces from Western Europe, or basing themselves in Western Europe. It was attacked by Napoleon, it was attacked by Hitler, and now it's got the expansion of NATO. It has always defended itself. Anybody who takes a quick look at history, you know, go and read War and Peace, and you'll find out or go read any history of World War II, and you'll find that Russia will defend itself. The United States made the calculation that Russia wouldn't defend itself, and this has then led to a very major war. Now the United States hopes that the effects of this war will be to weaken Russia. It hopes to overthrow Putin. This, unfortunately for them, all the polls show that the war is supported by the big majority of the population of Russia, because it sees it as a defensive war. There is no opposition to Putin which is pro-Western of any significance. The only major opposition to Putin, only major force in Russia which is independent of Putin is the Communist Party, and they support the war. So there's no chances of this political disintegration, and the United States has therefore got itself into a great mess in which by now, tens of thousands, more probably hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians are dying. And the United States is hoping that the U.S. population will continue to pay for this and not accept it, although it's attacking the living standards. Okay, well, that's a calculation. But they don't, you know, anybody who studies Russian history knows that Russia will fight ferociously in order to defend itself.
Right.
And that's exactly what it's doing. And the United States has made big miscalculation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
What do you think about how the United States is dealing with both Russia and China, because it's sanctioned both? I mean, aren't they not just driving these two powers closer together? And isn't that not to the benefit of Washington in the long run?
Well, it definitely is driving them closer. And it certainly, if it came to a conflict with China as well, it would be a serious situation for the United States in conducting this kind of war, even with their so-called alliances. But on the Ukraine situation, you've got to understand that the United States had a policy, and we go back to the writings of Zbigniew Brzezinski, that if they could pull Ukraine away from Russia, Russia would become a second-rate power because they would lose southern Russia, they would lose Crimea, etc. All of these things would go by the board, and they felt that that Russia would thereby be manageable, as it was to some extent under President Yeltsin. And that therefore they're playing a very dangerous game in Ukraine, where the Ukrainian people, unfortunately, are the casualties of a Western policy that is possibly leading us to nuclear war. This is a lack of understanding of Russia and basically a lack of understanding of the importance of Russia in the world economy. And the Europeans are suffering that, the United States less, because they're selling more to Europe, which can no longer buy Russian oil. And so they're profiting from it as well. But the world generally is suffering. The ones who are suffering the most are the Ukrainian people, who are subject to a government which has been under the heel of NATO and of the United States political establishment at least since 2014. And even before, when they manipulated the change of government.
Well, John, is the United States trying to do the same thing now with the situation in China, dealing with Taiwan? We've seen more and more American politicians go to Taiwan. And again, just like Russia had warned the United States about its red line, China has also warned the United States about its red line in dealing with Taiwan.
Yes, yeah, certainly the United States is playing with fire over the question of Taiwan. I mean, I always use the analogy for the United States. They should be able to understand it, the United States, very clearly. Who is generally regarded as the greatest president in the history of the United States? It's Abraham Lincoln. If you look at Abraham Lincoln objectively, what did he do? He crushed the separatists, that is the Confederacy, and he said, we're not going to have the United States split up, and if I have to go to war, which he then proceeded to do. And he is, we might call him, you know, Abraham Lincoln, great struggler against separatism. So the United States should be able to understand this. This is the same exactly with the question of Taiwan, apart from the fact when the Japanese stole Taiwan from China by aggression at the end of, at the end of the 19th century, Taiwan has always been part of China. Incidentally, not even the government of Taiwan denies that it's part of China. The so-called government in Taipei, it declares that there's one China. Mainland China says there's one China. One thing they all agree with is there's one China, except that the United States wants to play with the separatism. And the response of China will be equally as fierce as was Abraham Lincoln's. It'll be equally as fierce as did Russia's in the Ukraine. So the United States is really playing with fire over this issue, and I really, really hope that more sane heads may prevail, although given the present state in the United States, unfortunately, one can't be sure.
Yeah, indeed. Well, William, when we look at the now threats of increased sanctions against China, we know the economic relationship between China and the United States. Is this also something that can backfire against Washington itself if it continues to sanction China? Now, China is talking about actually the way the United States is trying to control competition and targeting foreign countries. Your take on that?
Well, it already has affected the United States, I think, in terms of much of the trade, that the U.S. would be in a better position today. If they had maintained trade with China, they'd probably be able to rebuild the economy much more than they've been able to do in the last few years. But the fact China's role in the world economy is such at this point that there is no possibility of a full decoupling unless you want to go back to a new dark ages for most of the world. And that's not going to change. That's a dynamic that cannot be controlled by government. What government is trying to do, therefore, is to restrict the input of high technology into China, which I think is a foolish endeavor. China has now a middle class, and John can correct me, about 400 million people. These people are being focused at this latest National People's Congress on the development of science and technology. The budget is increasing. The budget of basic scientific research is increasing, and you have a lot of smart people there. And smart people create new ideas, and the new ideas creates the new technology. So China may be hampered to some extent by the attempt by the U.S. and its allies, to the extent they want to go along with it. Some of them won't, to try and restrict technologies. They will develop it on their own. It may take them just a little longer, but they will do it. This is not a smart move to be made. And the question is whether the United States can, in fact, make the kind of investment under present economic conditions, including inflation, in high technology to really even get back on its feet. It may make some gains in semiconductors, but look at all the other spheres of activity in AI, in quantum computing, and all this other these other elements of the new technologies that they really haven't been doing enough investing in. The question is, will they be able to do it at the same time that they're putting these restrictions on China? I think it's not going to happen.
Well, John, I'd like to hear your short-term and long-term forecasts of where you see this going, China-U.S. relations.
Well, I think in the short term, we're going through, well, I'm using the short term in relative sense. Let's say the next 5 to 10 years. I think we're going through a very dangerous situation because the United States can't compete economically, as I outlined, and therefore it's increasingly tempted to either direct military means or indirect military means. These can be proxy wars, as in Ukraine. They can be attempt to destabilize countries. They can be putting pressure on countries to try to break off trade relations, all sorts of things. But the logic of the United States is, as it's losing economically, it keeps proclaiming how wonderful its economy is, but actually it's being outcompeted by China, that it will resort to military means. And this is a very dangerous situation. And that this is why, undoubtedly, China has to threat from the United States. I mean, if you look at United States military policy, it's been attempting to create a first strike nuclear capacity, and this is extremely dangerous. Over the longer run, China will become so strong, both technologically and economically, that the US won't be able to deal with it. China's R&D expenditure is already about the same level as the United States in absolute terms. It's been growing at 11% a year and the US at 4% a year. So by 2030, China will be considerably outspending the United States in R&D. China's got a project of doubling the size of its economy by 2035, which is its next key target. This will make it a much bigger economy than the United States. And I hope that the United States will then adjust down around to accepting this new reality. It's a terrible shock that a non-Christian, non-white, other country than the United States will be the largest economy in the world. But, you know, that's the situation that we're going to be in. So I hope after a period of time, the United States will just settle down to accepting this and not try to be threatening the situation. But I think we're going through, let's say, a very dangerous decade.
Okay. And on that note, it brings us to the end of the show. I appreciate both of you being with me. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review out of Washington, D.C. John Ross, Senior Fellow of Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, I have a very special guest speaker, Brother Suhail. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam. I would like to thank all the listeners to be part of this session, inshallah.
Inshallah. Now, recently in the world, so many earthquakes happens, you know, earthquakes happens, especially in Turkey. In Tajikistan, it happened again, the questions comes to our mind that, are these really the natural phenomena only, or, for example, they could be the result of some of our actions and some of our sins? Do we have any, for example, Quranic or narrative evidence showing us that the earthquake or the other disasters in the world that are taking place are because of our deeds and actions on this world or not? Brother Suhail, what's your answer to that?
Okay, so the question here at hand is this, that earthquakes are natural phenomena or the result of our sins?
Yes.
Generally, it's not this or that question.
Okay.
It's the middle way out.
Yes.
So it's a natural phenomenon as it is, as well as it has some relation to our kind of deeds. You see? So when an unexpected catastrophes happen, like earthquakes and other such as hurricanes and other natural calamities that occur, people from earliest time to present used it to prove God's justice, that okay, God's justice is not as just as they said. But this is not the truth. The relative judgment and limited knowledge that we have, normally all of us in our judgment, stress the relation things that have with us. For instance, we say such and such is near us or far from us. For example, we have rain. You see, rain is one of the calamities in some places. It rains, yes, and you see that some places get flooded.
Yes.
Really bad flood. So okay, it is also known as one of the phenomena and calamity. But the problem is because I'm looking at it as my perception, I feel it to be bad, you see. But I don't take into consideration that it's not only me living in this world. It's me, it's plants, it's animals, it's nature occurrences, cause and effects, you see. All of these are accumulated as one. So when a natural